Disc 2.
Because pinpoint timing was necessary for simultaneous detonation of the devices, the flux pods were interconnected over internet telephone lines. During the two-day countdown, the pods' internal clocks exchanged endless streams of encrypted synchronization data. The NSA intercepted the data pulses as a network anomaly, but ignored them as a seemingly harmless exchange of gibberish. But after Translator decrypted the data streams, analysts immediately recognized the sequence as a network-synchronized countdown. The pods were located and removed a full 3 hours before they were scheduled to go off. Susan knew that without Translator, the NSA was helpless against advanced electronic terrorism. She eyed the run monitor. It still read over 15 hours. Even if Tankato's file broke right now, the NSA was sunk. Crypto would be relegated to breaking less than 2 codes a day. Even at the present rate of 150 a day, there was still a backlog of files awaiting decryption.
"Tankato called me last month," Strathmore said, interrupting Susan's thoughts.
Susan looked up.
"Tankato called you?"
He nodded.
"To warn me."
"Warn you? He hates you."
"He called to tell me he was perfecting an algorithm that wrote unbreakable codes. I didn't believe him."
"But why would he tell you about it?" Susan demanded. "Did he want you to buy it?"
"No. It was blackmail."
Things suddenly began falling into place for Susan.
"Of course," she said, amazed. "He wanted you to clear his name."
"No," Strathmore frowned. "Tankato wanted Translator."
"Translator?"
"Yes, he ordered me to go public and tell the world we have Translator. He said if we admitted we can read public email, he would destroy Digital Fortress."
Susan looked doubtful. Strathmore shrugged.
"Either way, it's too late now. He's posted a complimentary copy of Digital Fortress at his internet site. Everyone in the world can download it."
Susan went white.
"He what?"
"It's a publicity stunt, nothing to worry about. The copy he posted is encrypted. People can download it, but nobody can open it. It's ingenious, really. The source code for Digital Fortress has been encrypted, locked shut."
Susan looked amazed.
"Of course. So everybody can have a copy, but nobody can open it."
"Exactly. Tankato's dangling a carrot."
"Have you seen the algorithm?"
The commander looked puzzled.
"No, I told you, it's encrypted."
Susan looked equally puzzled.
"But we've got Translator. Why not just decrypt it?"
But when Susan saw Strathmore's face, she realized the rules had changed.
"Oh, my God," she gasped, suddenly understanding. "Digital Fortress is encrypted with itself?"
Strathmore nodded.
"Bingo."
Susan was amazed. The formula for Digital Fortress had been encrypted using Digital Fortress. Tankato had posted a priceless mathematical recipe, but the text of the recipe had been scrambled, and it had used itself to do the scrambling.
"It's Bigelman's safe," Susan stammered in awe.
Strathmore nodded. Bigelman's safe was a hypothetical cryptography scenario in which a safe builder wrote blueprints for an unbreakable safe. He wanted to keep the blueprints a secret, so he built the safe and locked the blueprints inside. Tankato had done the same thing with Digital Fortress. He'd protected his blueprints by encrypting them with the formula outlined in his blueprints.
"And the file in Translator?" Susan asked.
"I downloaded it from Tankato's internet site like everyone else. The NSA is now the proud owner of the Digital Fortress algorithm. We just can't open it."
Susan marveled at Ensai Tankato's ingenuity. Without revealing his algorithm, he had proven to the NSA that it was unbreakable. Strathmore handed her a newspaper clipping. It was a translated blurb from the Nikkei Shimbun, the Japanese equivalent of the Wall Street Journal, stating that the Japanese programmer Ensai Tankato had completed a mathematical formula he claimed could write unbreakable codes. The formula was called Digital Fortress and was available for review on the internet. The programmer would be auctioning it off to the highest bidder. The column went on to say that although there was enormous interest in Japan, the few U.S. software companies who had heard about Digital Fortress deemed the claim preposterous, akin to turning lead to gold. The formula, they said, was a hoax and not to be taken seriously. Susan looked up.
An auction?
Strathmore nodded.
Right now, every software company in Japan has downloaded an encrypted copy of Digital Fortress and is trying to crack it open. Every second they can't, the bidding price climbs.
That's absurd, Susan shot back. All the new encrypted files are uncrackable unless you have translator. Digital Fortress could be nothing more than a generic public domain algorithm, and none of these companies could break it.
But it's a brilliant marketing ploy, Strathmore said. Think about it. All brands of bulletproof glass stop bullets, but if a company dares you to put a bullet through theirs, suddenly everybody's trying.
And the Japanese actually believe Digital Fortress is different? Better than everything else on the market?
Tankato may have been shunned, but everybody knows he's a genius. He's practically a cult icon among hackers. If Tankato says the algorithm's unbreakable, it's unbreakable.
But they're all unbreakable as far as the public knows.
Yes, Strathmore mused. For the moment.
What's that supposed to mean?
Strathmore sighed. 20 years ago, no one imagined we'd be breaking 12-bit stream ciphers. But technology progressed. It always does. Software manufacturers assume at some point computers like Translator will exist. Technology is progressing exponentially, and eventually current public key algorithms will lose their security. Better algorithms will be needed to stay ahead of tomorrow's computers.
And Digital Fortress is it?
Exactly. An algorithm that resists brute force will never become obsolete, no matter how powerful code-breaking computers get. It could become a world standard overnight.
Susan pulled in a long breath. God help us, she whispered. Can we make a bid?
Strathmore shook his head. Tankato gave us our chance. He made that clear. It's too risky anyway. If we get caught, we're basically admitting that we're afraid of his algorithm. We'd be making a public confession not only that we have Translator, but that Digital Fortress is immune.
What's the time frame?
Strathmore frowned. Tankato planned to announce the highest bidder tomorrow at noon.
Susan felt her stomach tighten. Then what?
The arrangement was that he would give the winner the passkey.
The passkey?
Part of the ploy. Everybody's already got the algorithm, so Tankato's auctioning off the passkey that unlocks it.
Susan groaned. Of course.
It was perfect. Clean and simple. Tankato had encrypted Digital Fortress, and he alone held the passkey that unlocked it.
She found it hard to fathom that somewhere out there, probably scrawled on a piece of paper in Tankato's pocket, there was a 64-character passkey that could end U.S. intelligence gathering forever. Susan suddenly felt ill as she imagined the scenario. Tankato would give his passkey to the highest bidder, and that company would unlock the Digital Fortress file. Then it probably would embed the algorithm in a tamper-proof chip, and within 5 years, every computer would come preloaded with a Digital Fortress chip. No commercial manufacturer had ever dreamed of creating an encryption chip because normal encryption algorithms eventually become obsolete. But Digital Fortress would never become obsolete. With a rotating clear text function, no brute force attack would ever find the right key. A new digital encryption standard. From now until forever. Every code unbreakable. Bankers, brokers, terrorists, spies. One world, one algorithm. Anarchy.
What are the options?
Susan probed. She was well aware that desperate times called for desperate measures, even at the NSA.
We can't remove him, if that's what you're asking.
It was exactly what Susan was asking. In her years with the NSA, Susan had heard rumors of its loose affiliations with the most skilled assassins in the world, hired hands brought in to do the intelligence community's dirty work. Strathmore shook his head.
Tankato's too smart to leave us an option like that.
Susan felt oddly relieved. He's protected?
Not exactly.
In hiding?
Strathmore shrugged. Tankato left Japan, He planned to check his bids by phone, but we know where he is.
And you don't plan to make a move?
No. He's got insurance. Tancado gave a copy of his passkey to an anonymous third party, in case anything happened.
Of course, Susan marveled. A guardian angel. And I suppose if anything happens to Tancado, the mystery man sells the key.
Worse. Anyone hits Tancado, and his partner publishes.
Susan looked confused. His partner publishes the key?
Strathmore nodded. Posts it on the internet, puts it in newspapers, on billboards. In effect, he gives it away.
Susan's eyes widened. Free downloads?
Exactly. Tancado figured if he was dead, he wouldn't need the money. Why not give the world a little farewell gift?
There was a long silence. Susan breathed deeply, as if to absorb the terrifying truth. Inside Tancado has created an unbreakable algorithm. He's holding us hostage.
She suddenly stood. Her voice was determined.
We must contact Tancado. There must be a way to convince him not to release. We can offer him triple the highest bid. We can clear his name. Anything.
Too late, Strathmore said. He took a deep breath. Ensai Tancado was found dead this morning in Seville, Spain.
Chapter 8. The twin-engine Learjet 60 touched down on the scorching runway. Outside the window, the barren landscape of Spain's lower Extremadura blurred and then slowed to a crawl.
Mr. Becker? A voice crackled. We're here.
Becker stood and stretched. After unlatching the overhead compartment, he remembered he had no luggage. There had been no time to pack. It didn't matter. He'd been promised the trip would be brief, in and out. As the engines wound down, the plane eased out of the sun and into a deserted hangar opposite the main terminal. A moment later, the pilot appeared and popped the hatch. Becker tossed back the last of his cranberry juice, put the glass on the wet bar, and scooped up his suit coat. The pilot pulled a thick manila envelope from his flight suit.
I was instructed to give you this.
He handed it to Becker. On the front, scrawled in blue pen, were the words, Keep the change. Becker thumbed through the thick stack of reddish bills.
What the? Local currency, the pilot offered flatly. I know what it is, Becker stammered, but it's too much. All I need is taxi fare.
Becker did the conversion in his head. What's in here is worth thousands of dollars.
I have my orders, sir.
The pilot turned and hoisted himself back into the cabin. The door slid shut behind him. Becker stared up at the plane and then down at the money in his hand. After standing a moment in the empty hangar, he put the envelope in his breast pocket, shouldered his suit coat, and headed out across the runway. It was a strange beginning. Becker pushed it from his mind. With a little luck, he'd be back in time to salvage some of his Stone Manor trip with Susan.
In and out, he told himself. In and out. There was no way he could have known.
Chapter 9. Systems security technician Phil Chartrukian had only intended to be inside Crypto a minute, just long enough to grab some paperwork he'd forgotten the day before. But it was not to be. After making his way across the crypto floor and stepping into the SysSec lab, he immediately knew something was not right. The computer terminal that perpetually monitored translators' internal workings was unmanned, and the monitor was switched off. Chartrukian called out,
Hello?
There was no reply. The lab was spotless, as if no one had been there for hours. Although Chartrukian was only 23 and relatively new to the SysSec squad, he'd been trained well, and he knew the drill. There was always a SysSec on duty in crypto, especially on Saturdays when no cryptographers were around. He immediately powered up the monitor and turned to the duty board on the wall.
Who's on watch? He demanded aloud, scanning the list of names.
According to the schedule, a young rookie named Seidenberg was supposed to have started a double shift at midnight the night before. Chartrukian glanced around the empty lab and frowned. So where the hell is he? As he watched the monitor power up, Chartrukian wondered if Strathmore knew the SysSec lab was unmanned. He had noticed on his way in that the curtains of Strathmore's workstation were closed, which meant the boss was in, not at all uncommon for a Saturday. Strathmore, despite requesting his cryptographers take Saturdays off, seemed to work 365 days a year. There was one thing Chartroukian knew for certain. If Strathmore found out the SysSec lab was unmanned, it would cost the absent rookie his job. Chartroukian eyed the phone, wondering if he should call the young techie and bail him out. There was an unspoken rule among SysSec that they would watch each other's backs. In crypto, SysSecs were second-class citizens, constantly at odds with the lords of the manor. It was no secret that the cryptographers ruled this multi-billion dollar roost. SysSecs were tolerated only because they kept the toys running smoothly. Chartroukian made his decision. He grabbed the phone, but the receiver never reached his ear. He stopped short, his eyes transfixed on the monitor now coming into focus before him. As if in slow motion, he set down the phone and stared in open-mouthed wonder. In 8 months as a SysSec, Phil Chartroukian had never seen Translator's run monitor post anything other than a double zero in the hours field. Today was a first. Time elapsed. 15 hours, 17 minutes, 21 seconds.
15 hours and 17 minutes? He choked. Impossible!
He rebooted the screen, praying it hadn't refreshed properly. But when the monitor came back to life, it looked the same. Chartroukian felt a chill. Crypto's SysSecs had only one responsibility. Keep Translator clean. Virus-free. Chartroukian knew that a 15-hour run could only mean one thing. Infection. An impure file had gotten inside Translator and was corrupting the programming. Instantly, his training kicked in. It no longer mattered that the SysSec lab had been unmanned or the monitors switched off. He focused on the matter at hand, Translator. He immediately called up a log of all the files that had entered Translator in the last 48 hours. He began scanning the list.
Did an infected file get through? He wondered. Could the security filters have missed something?
As a precaution, every file entering Translator had to pass through what was known as Gauntlet, a series of powerful circuit-level gateways, packet filters, and disinfectant programs that scanned inbound files for computer viruses and potentially dangerous subroutines. Files containing programming unknown to Gauntlet were immediately rejected. They had to be checked by hand. Occasionally, Gauntlet rejected entirely harmless files on the basis that they contained programming the filters had never seen before. In that case, the SysSecs did a scrupulous manual inspection, and only then, on confirmation that the file was clean, did they bypass Gauntlet's filters and send the file into Translator. Computer viruses were as varied as bacterial viruses. Like their physiological counterparts, computer viruses had one goal: to attach themselves to a host system and replicate. In this case, the host was Translator. Chartroukian was amazed the NSA hadn't had problems with viruses before. Gauntlet was a potent sentry, but still, the NSA was a bottom feeder, sucking in massive amounts of digital information from systems all over the world. Snooping data was a lot like having indiscriminate sex. Protection or no protection, sooner or later you caught something. Chartroukian finished examining the file list before him. He was now more puzzled than before. Every file checked out. Gauntlet had seen nothing out of the ordinary, which meant the file in Translator was totally clean.
So what the hell's taking so long? He demanded of the empty room.
Chartroukian felt himself break a sweat. He wondered if he should go disturb Strathmore with the news.
A virus probe, Chartroukian said firmly, trying to calm himself down. I should run a virus probe.
Chartroukian knew that a virus probe would be the first thing Strathmore would request anyway. Glancing out at the deserted crypto floor, Chartroukian made his decision. He loaded the viral probe software and launched it. The run would take about 15 minutes.
Come back clean, he whispered. Squeaky clean. Tell Daddy it's nothing.
But Chartroukian sensed it was not nothing. Instinct told him something very unusual was going on inside the great decoding beast. Chapter 10.
Ensai Tankado is dead?
Susan felt a wave of nausea.
You killed him? I thought you said...
We didn't touch him, Strathmore assured her. He died of a heart attack. ComInt phoned early this morning. Their computer flagged Tancado's name in a Seville police log through Interpol.
Heart attack? Susan looked doubtful. He was 30 years old.
32, Strathmore corrected. He had a congenital heart defect.
I'd never heard that.
Turned up in his NSA physical, not something he bragged about.
Susan was having trouble accepting the serendipity of the timing.
A defective heart could kill him, just like that?
It seemed too convenient. Strathmore shrugged.
Weak heart, combine it with the heat of Spain, throw in the stress of blackmailing the NSA.
Susan was silent a moment. Even considering the conditions, she felt a pang of loss at the passing of such a brilliant fellow cryptographer. Strathmore's gravelly voice interrupted her thoughts.
The only silver lining on this whole fiasco is that Tancado was traveling alone. Chances are good his partner doesn't know yet he's dead. The Spanish authorities said they'd contain the information for as long as possible. We only got the call because ComInt was on the ball.
Strathmore eyed Susan closely.
I've got to find the partner before he finds out Tancado's dead. That's why I called you in. I need your help.
Susan was confused. It seemed to her that Ensai Tancado's timely demise had solved their entire problem.
Commander, she argued, if the authorities are saying he died of a heart attack, we're off the hook. His partner will know the NSA is not responsible.
Not responsible?
Strathmore's eyes widened in disbelief.
Somebody blackmails the NSA and turns up dead a few days later, and we're not responsible? I'd bet big money Tancado's mystery friend won't see it that way. Whatever happened, we look guilty as hell. It could easily have been poison, a rigged autopsy, any number of things.
Strathmore paused.
What was your first reaction when I told you Tancado was dead?
She frowned. I thought the NSA had killed him.
Exactly. If the NSA can put 5 Rhyolite satellites in geosynchronous orbit over the Mideast, I think it's safe to assume we have the resources to pay off a few Spanish policemen.
The commander had made his point. Susan exhaled.
Ensai Tancado is dead. The NSA will be blamed. Can we find his partner in time?
I think so. We've got a good lead. Tancado made numerous public announcements that he was working with a partner. I think he hoped it would discourage software firms from doing him any harm or trying to steal his key. He threatened that if there was any foul play, his partner would publish the key, and all firms would suddenly find themselves in competition with free software.
Clever, Susan nodded. Strathmore went on.
A few times in public, Tancado referred to his partner by name. He called him North Dakota.
North Dakota? Obviously an alias of some sort.
Yes, but as a precaution, I ran an internet inquiry using North Dakota as a search string. I didn't think I'd find anything, but I turned up an email account.
Strathmore paused.
Of course, I assumed it wasn't the North Dakota we were looking for, but I searched the account just to be sure. Imagine my shock when I found the account was full of email from Ensai Tancado.
Strathmore raised his eyebrows.
And the messages were full of references to Digital Fortress and Tancado's plans to blackmail the NSA.
Susan gave Strathmore a skeptical look. She was amazed the commander was letting himself be played with so easily.
Commander, she argued, Tancado knows full well the NSA can snoop email from the Internet. He would never use email to send secret information. It's a trap. Ensai Tancado gave you North Dakota. He knew you'd run a search. Whatever information he's sending, he wanted you to find. It's a false trail.
Good instinct, Strathmore fired back, except for a couple of things. I couldn't find anything under North Dakota, so I tweaked the search string. The account I found was under a variation. N-Dakota.
Susan shook her head.
Running permutations is standard procedure. Tancado knew you'd try variations until you hit something. N-Dakota's far too easy an alteration.
Perhaps,
Strathmore said, scribbling words on a piece of paper and handing it to Susan.
But look at this.
Susan read the paper. She suddenly understood the commander's thinking. On the paper, was North Dakota's email address, ndakota@ara.anon.org. It was the letters ARA in the address that had caught Susan's eye. ARA stood for American Remailers Anonymous, a well-known anonymous server. Anonymous servers were popular among Internet users who wanted to keep their identities secret. For a fee, these companies protected an emailer's privacy by acting as a middleman for electronic mail. It was like having a numbered post office box. A user could send and receive email without ever revealing his true address or name. The company received email addressed to aliases and then forwarded it to the client's real account. The remailing company was bound by contract never to reveal the identity or location of its real users.
"It's not proof," Strathmore said, "but it's pretty suspicious."
Susan nodded, suddenly more convinced.
"So you're saying Tankato didn't care if anybody searched for North Dakota because his identity and location are protected by ARA?"
"Exactly."
Susan schemed for a moment.
"ARA services mainly U.S. accounts. You think North Dakota might be over here somewhere?"
Strathmore shrugged.
"Could be. With an American partner, Tankato could keep the two passkeys separated geographically. Might be a smart move."
Susan considered it. She doubted Tankato would have shared his passkey with anyone except a very close friend, and as she recalled, Ensai Tankato didn't have many friends in the States.
"North Dakota," she mused,
her cryptological mind mulling over the possible meanings of the alias.
"What does his email to Tankato sound like?"
"No idea. Comint caught only Tankato's outbound. At this point, all we have on North Dakota is an anonymous address."
Susan thought a minute.
"Any chance it's a decoy?"
Strathmore raised an eyebrow.
"How so?"
"Tankato could be sending bogus email to a dead account in hopes we'd snoop it. We'd think he's protected, and he'd never have to risk sharing his passkey. He could be working alone."
Strathmore chuckled, impressed.
"Tricky idea, except for one thing. He's not using any of his usual home or business internet accounts. He's been dropping by Doshisha University and logging on to their mainframe. Apparently he's got an account there that he's managed to keep secret. It's a very well-hidden account, and I found it only by chance."
Strathmore paused.
"So, if Tankato wanted us to snoop his mail, why would he use a secret account?"
Susan contemplated the question.
"Maybe he used a secret account so you wouldn't suspect a ploy. Maybe Tankato hid the account just deep enough that you'd stumble onto it and think you got lucky. It gives his email credibility."
Strathmore chuckled.
"You should have been a field agent. The idea's a good one. Unfortunately, every letter Tankato sends gets a response. Tankato writes, his partner responds."
Susan frowned.
"Fair enough.
So you're saying North Dakota's for real?" "Afraid so. And we've got to find him, and quietly. If he catches wind that we're onto him, it's all over."
Susan now knew exactly why Strathmore had called her in.
"Let me guess," she said. "You want me to snoop ARA's secure database and find North Dakota's real identity?"
Strathmore gave her a tight smile.
"Ms. Fletcher, you read my mind."
When it came to discreet internet searches, Susan Fletcher was the woman for the job. A year ago, a senior White House official had been receiving email threats from someone with an anonymous email address. The NSA had been asked to locate the individual. Although the NSA had the clout to demand the remailing company reveal the user's identity, it opted for a more subtle method, a tracer. Susan had created, in effect, a directional beacon disguised as a piece of email. She could send it to the user's phony address, and the remailing company, performing the duty for which it had been contracted, would forward it to the user's real address. Once there, the program would record its internet location and send word back to the NSA. Then the program would disintegrate without a trace. From that day on, as far as the NSA was concerned, anonymous remailers were nothing more than a minor annoyance.
"Can you find him?" Strathmore asked.
"Sure. Why did you wait so long to call me?"
"Actually," he frowned, "I hadn't planned on calling you at all. I didn't want anyone else in the loop. I tried to send a copy of your tracer myself, but you wrote the damn thing in one of those new hybrid languages. I couldn't get it to work.
It kept returning nonsensical data. I finally had to bite the bullet and bring you in."
Susan chuckled. Strathmore was a brilliant cryptographic programmer, but his repertoire was limited primarily to algorithmic work. The nuts and bolts of less lofty, secular programming often escaped him. What was more, Susan had written her tracer in a new crossbreed programming language called Limbo. It was understandable that Strathmore had encountered problems.
"I'll take care of it," she smiled, turning to leave. "I'll be at my terminal."
"Any idea on time frame?"
Susan paused. "Well, it depends on how efficiently ARA forwards their mail. If he's here in the States and uses something like AOL or CompuServe, I'll snoop his credit card and get a billing address within the hour. If he's with a university or a corporation, it'll take a little longer." She smiled uneasily. "After that, the rest is up to you." Susan knew that the rest would be an NSA strike team cutting power to the guy's house and crashing through his windows with stun guns. The team would probably think it was on a drug bust. Strathmore would undoubtedly stride through the rubble himself and locate the 64-character passkey. Then he would destroy it. Digital Fortress would languish forever on the Internet, locked for all eternity.
"Send the tracer carefully," Strathmore urged. "If North Dakota sees we're onto him, he'll panic, and I'll never get a team there before he disappears with the key."
"Hit and run," she assured. "The moment this thing finds his account, it'll dissolve. He'll never know we were there." The commander nodded tiredly.
"Thanks."
Susan gave him a soft smile. She was always amazed how even in the face of disaster, Chapter 11. Spain. "I sent David to Spain." The commander's words stung.
"David's in Spain?"
Susan was incredulous.
"You sent him to Spain?"
Her tone turned angry.
"Why?"
Strathmore looked dumbfounded. He was apparently not accustomed to being yelled at, even by his head cryptographer. He gave Susan a confused look. She was flexed like a mother tiger defending her cub.
"Susan," he said, "you spoke to him, didn't you? David did explain."
She was too shocked to speak.
"Spain? That's why David postponed our Stone Manor trip?"
"I sent a car for him this morning. He said he was going to call you before he left. I'm sorry, I thought..."
"Why would you send David to Spain?"
Strathmore paused and gave her an obvious look.
"To get the other pass key."
"What other pass key?"
"Tancado's copy."
Susan was lost.
"What are you talking about?"
Strathmore sighed.
"Tancado surely would have had a copy of the pass key on him when he died. I sure as hell didn't want it floating around the Seville morgue."
"So you sent David Becker?"
Susan was beyond shock. Nothing was making sense.
"David doesn't even work for you."
Strathmore looked startled. No one ever spoke to the deputy director of the NSA that way.
"Susan," he said, keeping his cool, "that's the point. I needed..."
The tiger lashed out.
"You've got 20,000 employees at your command. What gives you the right to send my fiancé?"
"I needed a civilian courier. Someone totally removed from government. If I went through regular channels and someone caught wind..."
"And David Becker is the only civilian you know?"
"No, David Becker is not the only civilian I know. But at 6 this morning, things were happening quickly. David speaks the language, he's smart, I trust him, and I thought I'd do him a favor."
"A favor?" Susan sputtered. "Sending him to Spain is a favor?"
"Yes. I'm paying him $10,000 for one day's work. He'll pick up Tancada's belongings and he'll fly home. That's a favor."
Susan fell silent. She understood. It was all about money. Her thoughts wheeled back 5 months to the night the president of Georgetown University had offered David a promotion to the language department chair. The president had warned him that his teaching hours would be cut back and that there would be increased paperwork, but there was also a substantial raise in salary. Susan had wanted to cry out,
"David, don't do it. You'll be miserable. We have plenty of money. Who cares which one of us earns it?"
But it was not her place. In the end, she stood by his decision to accept. As they fell asleep that night, Susan tried to be happy for him, but something inside kept telling her it would be a disaster. She'd been right. but she never counted on being so right.
You paid him $10,000? She demanded. That's a dirty trick.
Strathmore was fuming now.
Trick? It wasn't any goddamn trick. I didn't even tell him about the money. I asked him as a personal favor, and he agreed to go.
Of course he agreed. You're my boss. You're the deputy director of the NSA. He couldn't say no.
You're right, Strathmore snapped, which is why I called him. I didn't have the luxury of...
Does the director know you sent a civilian?
Susan,
Strathmore said, his patience obviously wearing thin.
The director is not involved. He knows nothing about this.
Susan stared at Strathmore in disbelief. It was as if she no longer knew the man she was talking to. He had sent her fiancé, a teacher, on an NSA mission, and then failed to notify the director about the biggest crisis in the history of the organization.
Leland Fontaine hasn't been notified?
Strathmore had reached the end of his rope. He exploded.
Susan, now listen here. I called you in here because I need an ally, not an inquiry. I've had one hell of a morning. I downloaded Tancaro's file last night and sat here by the output printer for hours praying Translator could break it. At dawn, I swallowed my pride and dialed the director, and let me tell you, that was a conversation I was really looking forward to. Good morning, sir. I'm sorry to wake you. Why am I calling? I just found out Translator is obsolete. It's because of an algorithm my entire top crypto team couldn't come close to writing.
Strathmore slammed his fist on the desk. Susan stood frozen. She didn't make a sound. In 10 years, she had seen Strathmore lose his cool only a handful of times, and never once with her. 10 seconds later, neither one of them had spoken. Finally, Strathmore sat back down, and Susan could hear his breathing slowing to normal. When he finally spoke, his voice was eerily calm and controlled.
Unfortunately, Strathmore said quietly, it turns out the director is in South America meeting with the president of Colombia. Because there's absolutely nothing he could do from down there, I had two options. Request he cut his meeting short and return, or handle this myself.
There was a long silence. Strathmore finally looked up, and his tired eyes met Susan's. His expression softened immediately.
Susan, I'm sorry. I'm exhausted. This is a nightmare come true. I know you're upset about David. I didn't mean for you to find out this way. I thought you knew.
Susan felt a wave of guilt.
I overreacted. I'm sorry.
David is a good choice. Strathmore nodded absently.
He'll be back tonight.
Susan thought about everything the commander was going through, the pressure of overseeing Translator, the endless hours and meetings. It was rumored his wife of 30 years was leaving him. Then on top of it, there was Digital Fortress, the biggest intelligence threat in the history of the NSA, and the poor guy was flying solo. No wonder he looked about to crack.
Considering the circumstances, Susan said, I think you should probably call the director.
Strathmore shook his head, a bead of sweat dripping on his desk.
I'm not about to compromise the director's safety or risk a leak by contacting him about a major crisis he can do nothing about.
Susan knew he was right. Even in moments like these, Strathmore was clear-headed.
Have you considered calling the president?
Strathmore nodded.
Yes. I've decided against it.
Susan had figured as much. Senior NSA officials had the right to handle verifiable intelligence emergencies without executive knowledge. The NSA was the only U.S. intelligence organization that enjoyed total immunity from federal accountability of any sort. Strathmore often availed himself of this right. He preferred to work his magic in isolation.
Commander, she argued, this is too big to be handled alone. You've got to let somebody else in on it.
Susan, the existence of Digital Fortress has major implications for the future of this organization. I have no intention of informing the president behind the director's back. We have a crisis, and I'm handling it.
He eyed her thoughtfully.
I am the deputy director of operations.
A weary smile crept across his face.
And besides, I'm not alone. I've got Susan Fletcher on my team.
In that instant, Susan realized what she respected so much about Trevor Strathmore. For 10 years, through thick and thin, he had always led the way for her, steadfast, unwavering. It was his dedication that amazed her. his unshakable allegiance to his principles, his country, and his ideals. Come what may, Commander Trevor Strathmore was a guiding light in a world of impossible decisions.
"You are on my team, aren't you?" he asked.
Susan smiled. "Yes, sir, I am. 100%.
Good. Now can we get back to work?"
Chapter 12. David Becker had been to funerals and seen dead bodies before, but there was something particularly unnerving about this one. It was not an immaculately groomed corpse resting in a silk-lined coffin. This body had been stripped naked and dumped unceremoniously on an aluminum table. The eyes had not yet found their vacant, lifeless gaze. Instead, they were twisted upward toward the ceiling in an eerie freeze frame of terror and regret.
"¿Dónde están sus efectos?" Becker asked in fluent Castilian Spanish.
"Where are his belongings?"
"Ahí,"
replied the yellow-toothed lieutenant. He pointed to a counter of clothing and other personal items.
"¿Es todo?"
"Is that all?"
"Sí."
Becker asked for a cardboard box. The lieutenant hurried off to find one. It was Saturday evening, and the Seville morgue was technically closed. The young lieutenant had let Becker in under direct orders from the head of the Seville Guardia. It seemed the visiting American had powerful friends. Becker eyed the pile of clothes. There was a passport, wallet, and glasses stuffed into one of the shoes. There was also a small duffel the Guardia had taken from the man's hotel. Becker's directions were clear. Touch nothing, read nothing, just bring it all back, everything. Don't miss anything. Becker surveyed the pile and frowned. What could the NSA possibly want with this junk? The lieutenant returned with a small box, and Becker began putting the clothes inside. The officer poked at the cadaver's leg.
¿Quién es?
Who is he?
No idea. Looks Chinese.
Japanese, Becker thought.
Poor bastard.
Heart attack, huh?
Becker nodded absently. That's what they told me. The lieutenant sighed and shook his head sympathetically.
The Seville sun can be cruel. Be careful out there tomorrow.
Thanks, Becker said, but I'm headed home. The officer looked shocked.
You just got here.
I know, but the guy paying my airfare is waiting for these items. The lieutenant looked offended in the way only a Spaniard can be offended.
You mean you're not going to experience Seville?
I was here years ago. Beautiful city. I'd love to stay.
So you've seen La Giralda?
Becker nodded. He'd never actually climbed the ancient Moorish tower, but he'd seen it.
How about the Alcazar?
Becker nodded again, remembering the night he'd heard Paco de Lucia play guitar in the courtyard. Flamenco under the stars in a 15th-century fortress. He wished he'd known Susan back then.
And of course there's Christopher Columbus, the officer beamed. He's buried in our cathedral.
Becker looked up.
Really?
I thought Columbus was buried in the Dominican Republic.
Hell no, who starts these rumors? Columbus's body is here in Spain. I thought you said you went to college.
Becker shrugged. I must have missed that day.
The Spanish Church is very proud to own his relics.
The Spanish Church? Becker knew there was only one church in Spain, the Roman Catholic Church. Catholicism was bigger here than in Vatican City.
We don't, of course, have his entire body, the lieutenant added. Solo el escroto.
Becker stopped packing and stared at the lieutenant.
Solo el escroto?
He fought off a grin.
Just his scrotum?
The officer nodded proudly.
Yes, when the church obtains the remains of a great man, they saint him and spread the relics to different cathedrals so everyone can enjoy their splendor.
And you got the...
Becker stifled a laugh.
Oye, it's a pretty important part, the officer defended. It's not like we got a rib or a knuckle like those churches in Galicia. You should really stay and see it.
Becker nodded politely. Maybe I'll drop in on my way out of town.
Mala suerte,
the officer sighed.
Bad luck.
The cathedral's closed till sunrise mass.
Another time then, Becker smiled, hoisting the box. I should probably get going, my flight's waiting. He made a final glance around the room.
You want a ride to the airport?
The the officer asked. I've got a Moto Guzzi out front.
No thanks, I'll catch a cab.
Becker had driven a motorcycle once in college and nearly killed himself on it. He had no intention of getting on one again, regardless of who was driving.
Whatever you say, the officer said, heading for the door. I'll get the lights.
Becker tucked the box under his arm.
Have I got everything?
He took a last look at the body on the table. The figure was stark naked, face up under fluorescent lights, clearly hiding nothing. Becker found his eyes drawn again to the strangely deformed hands. He gazed a minute, focusing more intently. The officer killed the lights, and the room went dark.
Hold on, Becker said. Turn those back on.
The lights flickered back on. Becker set his box on the floor and walked over to the corpse. He leaned down and squinted at the man's left hand. The officer followed Becker's gaze.
Pretty ugly, huh?
But the deformity was not what had caught Becker's eye. He'd seen something else. He turned to the officer.
You're sure everything's in this box?
The officer nodded.
Yeah, that's it.
Becker stood for a moment with his hands on his hips. Then he picked up the box, carried it back over to the counter, and dumped it out. Carefully, piece by piece, he shook out the clothing. Then he emptied the shoes and tapped them as if trying to remove a pebble. After going over everything a second time, he stepped back and frowned.
Problem? Asked the lieutenant.
Yeah, Becker said. We're missing something. Chapter 13. Tokugen Numataka stood in his plush penthouse office and gazed out at the Tokyo skyline. His employees and competitors knew him as Akuta Same, the deadly shark. For 3 decades, he'd outguessed, outbid, and out-advertised all the Japanese competition. Now he was on the brink of becoming a giant in the world market as well. He was about to close the biggest deal of his life, a deal that would make his Numatek Corp the Microsoft of the future. His blood was alive with the cool rush of adrenaline. Business was war, and war was exciting. Although Tokugen Numataka had been suspicious when the call had come 3 days ago, he now knew the truth. He was blessed with Mayuri, good fortune. The gods had chosen him.
I have a copy of the Digital Fortress passkey, the American accent had said. Would you like to buy it?
Numataka had almost laughed out loud. He knew it was a ploy. Numatek Corp had bid generously for Ensai Tankado's new algorithm, and now one of Numatek's competitors was playing games, trying to find out the amount of the bid.
You have the passkey? Numataka feigned interest.
I do. My name is North Dakota.
Numataka stifled a laugh. Everyone knew about North Dakota. Tankado had told the press about his secret partner. It had been a wise move on Tankado's part to have a partner. Even in Japan, business practices had become dishonorable. Ensai Tankado was not safe, but one false move by an overeager firm and the passkey would be published. Every software firm on the market would suffer. Numataka took a long pull on his umami cigar and played along with the caller's pathetic charade.
So, you're selling your passkey? Interesting. How does Ensai Tankado feel about this?
I have no allegiance to Mr. Tankado. Mr. Tankado was foolish to trust me. The passkey is worth hundreds of times what he is paying me to handle it for him.
I'm sorry, Numataka said. Your passkey alone is worth nothing to me. When Tankado finds out what you've done, he will simply publish his copy, and the market will be flooded.
You will receive both passkeys, the voice said. Mr. Tankado's and mine.
Numataka covered the receiver and laughed aloud. He couldn't help asking,
How much are you asking for both keys?
$20 million.
$20 million was almost exactly what Numataka had bid.
$20 million? He gasped in mock horror. That's outrageous.
I've seen the algorithm. I assure you, it's well worth it.
No shit, thought Numataka. It's worth 10 times that.
Unfortunately, he said, tiring of the game, we both know Mr. Tankado would never stand for this. Think of the legal repercussions.
The caller paused ominously. What if Mr. Tankado were no longer a factor? Numataka wanted to laugh, but he noted an odd determination in the voice.
If Tankado were no longer a factor?
Numataka considered it.
Then you and I would have a deal.
I'll be in touch, the voice said. The line went dead. Chapter 14. Becker gazed down at the cadaver. Even hours after death, the Asian's face radiated with a pinkish glow of a recent sunburn. The rest of him was a pale yellow, all except the small area of purplish bruising directly over his heart. Probably from the CPR, Becker mused. Too bad it didn't work. He went back to studying the cadaver's hands. They were like nothing Becker had ever seen. Each hand had only 3 digits, and they were twisted and askew. The disfigurement, however, was not what Becker was looking at.
Well, I'll be, the lieutenant grunted from across the room. He's Japanese, not Chinese.
Becker looked up. The officer was thumbing through the dead man's passport. I'd rather you didn't look at that, Becker requested.
Touch nothing, read nothing.
Ensai Tankado,
born January?
Please, Becker said politely.
Put it back.
The officer stared at the passport a moment longer, and then tossed it back on the pile.
This guy's got a Class 3 visa. He could have stayed here for years.
Becker poked at the victim's hand with a pen.
Maybe he lived here.
Nope.
Date of entry was last week.
Maybe he was moving here, Becker offered curtly.
Yeah, maybe. Crummy first week, sunstroke and a heart attack. Poor bastard.
Becker ignored the officer and studied the hand.
You're positive he wasn't wearing any jewelry when he died?
The officer looked up, startled.
Jewelry?
Yeah, take a look at this. The officer crossed the room. The skin on Tankado's left hand showed traces of sunburn, everywhere except a narrow band of flesh around the smallest finger. Becker pointed to the strip of pale flesh.
See how this isn't sunburned here?
Looks like he was wearing a ring.
The officer seemed surprised.
A ring?
His voice sounded suddenly perplexed. He studied the corpse's finger. Then he flushed, sheepishly.
My God, he chuckled. The story was true?
Becker had a sudden sinking feeling.
I beg your pardon?
The officer shook his head in disbelief.
I would have mentioned it before, but I thought the guy was nuts.
Becker was not smiling.
What guy?
The guy who phoned in the emergency. Some Canadian tourist. Kept talking about a ring, babbling in the worst damn Spanish I ever heard.
He said Mr. Tankado was wearing a ring? The officer nodded. He pulled out a Ducato cigarette, eyed the no fumar sign, and lit up anyway.
Guess I should have said something, but the guy sounded totally loco.
Becker frowned. Strathmore's words echoed in his ears.
I want everything Ensai Tankado had with him. Everything. Leave nothing. Not even a tiny scrap of paper.
Where's the ring now? Becker asked. The officer took a puff.
Long story.
Something told Becker this was not good news.
Tell me anyway.
Chapter 15. Susan Fletcher sat at her computer terminal inside Node 3. Node 3 was the cryptographer's private soundproof chamber just off the main floor. A 2-inch sheet of curved one-way glass gave the cryptographers a panorama of the crypto floor while prohibiting anyone else from seeing inside. At the back of the expansive Node 3 chamber, 12 terminals sat in a perfect circle. The annular arrangement was intended to encourage intellectual exchange between cryptographers, to remind them they were part of a larger team. Something like a codebreaker's Knights of the Round Table. Ironically, secrets were frowned on inside Node 3. Nicknamed the Playpen, Node 3 had none of the sterile feel of the rest of crypto. It was designed to feel like home. Plush carpets, high-tech sound system, fully stocked fridge, kitchenette, a Nerf basketball hoop. The NSA had a philosophy about crypto. Don't drop a couple billion bucks into a code-breaking computer without enticing the best of the best to stick around and use it. Susan slipped out of her Salvatore Ferragamo flats and dug her stockinged toes into the thick pile carpet. Well-paid government employees were encouraged to refrain from lavish displays of personal wealth. It was usually no problem for Susan. She was perfectly happy with her modest duplex, Volvo sedan, and conservative wardrobe. But shoes were another matter. Even when Susan was in college, she'd budgeted for the best. "You can't jump for the stars if your feet hurt," her aunt had once told her. "And when you get where you're going, you darn well better look great." Susan allowed herself a luxurious stretch and then settled down to business. She pulled up her tracer and prepared to configure it. She glanced at the email address Strathmore had given her, ndakota@ara.anon.org. The man calling himself North Dakota had an anonymous account, but Susan knew it would not remain anonymous for long. The tracer would pass through ARA, get forwarded to North Dakota, and then send information back containing the man's real internet address. If all went well, it would locate North Dakota soon, and Strathmore could confiscate the passkey. That would leave only David. When he found Tancado's copy, both passkeys could be destroyed. Tancado's little time bomb would be harmless, a deadly explosive without a detonator. Susan double-checked the address on the sheet in front of her and entered the information in the correct data field. She chuckled that Strathmore had encountered difficulty sending the tracer himself. Apparently, he'd sent it twice, both times receiving Tancado's address back rather than North Dakota's. It was a simple mistake, Susan thought. Strathmore had probably interchanged the data fields, and the tracer had searched for the wrong account. Susan finished configuring her tracer and queued it for release. Then she hit return. The computer beeped once. Tracer sent. Now came the waiting game. Susan exhaled. She felt guilty for having been hard on the commander. If there was anyone qualified to handle this threat single-handed, it was Trevor Strathmore. He had an uncanny way of getting the best of all those who challenged him. 6 months ago, when the EFF broke a story that an NSA submarine was snooping underwater telephone cables, Strathmore calmly leaked a conflicting story that the submarine was actually illegally burying toxic waste. The EFF and the oceanic environmentalists spent so much time bickering over which version was true, the media eventually tired of the story and moved on. Every move Strathmore made was meticulously planned. He depended heavily on his computer when devising and revising his plans. Like many NSA employees, Strathmore used NSA-developed software called Brainstorm, a risk-free way to carry out what-if scenarios in the safety of a computer. Brainstorm was an artificial intelligence experiment described by its developers as a cause-and-effect simulator. It originally had been intended for use in political campaigns as a way to create real-time models of a given political environment. Fed by enormous amounts of data, the program created a relationary web, a hypothesized model of interaction between political variables, including current prominent figures, their staffs, their personal ties to each other, hot issues, individuals' motivations weighted by variables like sex, ethnicity, money, and power. The user could then enter any hypothetical event, and Brainstorm would predict the event's effect on the environment. Commander Strathmore worked religiously with Brainstorm, not for political purposes, but as a TFM device. Timeline, flowchart, and mapping software was a powerful tool for outlining complex strategies and predicting weaknesses. Susan suspected there were schemes hidden in Strathmore's computer that someday would change the world. Yes, Susan thought, I was too hard on him. Her thoughts were jarred by the hiss of the Node 3 doors. Strathmore burst in.
Susan, he said, David just called. There's been a setback.
Chapter 16.
A ring? Susan looked doubtful. Tancado's missing a ring?
Yes. We're lucky David caught it. It was a real heads-up play.
But you're after a passkey, not jewelry.
I know, Strathmore said. But I think they might be one and the same.
Susan looked lost.
It's a long story.
She motioned to the tracer on her screen.
I'm not going anywhere.
Strathmore sighed heavily and began pacing.
Apparently there were witnesses to Tancado's death. According to the officer at the morgue, a Canadian tourist called DeGuardia this morning in a panic. He said a Japanese man was having a heart attack in the park. When the officer arrived, he found Tancado dead and the Canadian there with him, so he radioed the paramedics. While the paramedics took Tancado's body to the morgue, the officer tried to get the Canadian to tell him what happened. All the old guy did was babble about some ring Tancado had given away right before he died.
Susan eyed him skeptically. Tancado gave away a ring?
Yeah. Apparently he forced it in this old guy's face like he was begging him to take it. Sounds like the old guy got a close look at it.
Strathmore stopped pacing and turned.
He said the ring was engraved with some sort of lettering.
Lettering?
Yes, and according to him, it wasn't English.
Strathmore raised his eyebrows expectantly. Japanese? Strathmore shook his head.
My first thought, too. But get this. The Canadian complained that the letters didn't spell anything. Japanese characters could never be confused with our Roman lettering. He said the engraving looked like a cat had gotten loose on a typewriter.
Susan laughed. Commander, you don't really think... Strathmore cut her off.
Susan, it's crystal clear. Tancado engraved the digital fortress pass key on his ring. Gold is durable. Whether he's sleeping, showering, eating, the pass key would always be with him, ready at a moment's notice for instant publication.
Susan looked dubious. On his finger? In the open like that?
Why not? Spain isn't exactly the encryption capital of the world. Nobody would have any idea what the letters meant. Besides, if the key is a standard 64-bit, even in broad daylight, nobody could possibly read and memorize all 64 characters.
Susan looked perplexed. And Tancado gave this ring to a total stranger moments before he died. Why? Strathmore's gaze narrowed.
Why do you think?
It took Susan only a moment before it clicked. Her eyes widened. Strathmore nodded.
Tancado was trying to get rid of it. He thought we'd killed him. He felt himself dying and logically assumed we were responsible. The timing was too coincidental. He figured we'd gotten to him, poison or something, a slow-acting cardiac arrester. He knew the only way we'd dare kill him is if we'd found North Dakota.
Susan felt a chill. Of course, she whispered. Tancado thought that we neutralized his insurance policy so we could remove him, too. It was all coming clear to Susan. The timing of the heart attack was so fortunate for the NSA that Tancado had assumed the NSA was responsible. His final instinct was revenge. Ensai gave away his ring as a last-ditch effort to publish the passkey. Now, incredibly, some unsuspecting Canadian tourist held the key to the most powerful encryption algorithm in history. Susan sucked in a deep breath and asked the inevitable question. So where is the Canadian now? Strathmore frowned.
That's the problem.
The officer doesn't know where he is?
No. The Canadian's story was so absurd that the officer figured he was either in shock or senile, so he put the old guy on the back of his motorcycle to take him back to his hotel. But the Canadian didn't know enough to hang on. He fell off before they'd gone 3 feet, cracked his head, and broke his wrist.
What? Susan choked.
The officer wanted to take him to a hospital, but the Canadian was furious. Said he'd walk back to Canada before he'd get on the motorcycle again. So all the officer could do was walk him to a small public clinic near the park. He left him there to get checked out.
Susan frowned. I assume there's no need to ask where David is headed. Chapter 17. David Becker stepped out onto the scorching tile concourse of Plaza de España. Before him, El Ayuntamiento, the ancient city council building, rose from the trees on a 3-acre bed of blue and white azulejo tiles. Its Arabic spires and carved facade gave the impression it had been intended more as a palace than a public office. Despite its history of military coups, fires, and public hangings, most tourists visited because the local brochures plugged it as the English military headquarters in the film Lawrence of Arabia. It had been far cheaper for Columbia Pictures to film in Spain than in Egypt, and the Moorish influence on Seville's architecture was enough to convince moviegoers they were looking at Cairo. Becker reset his Seiko for local time, 9:10 p.m.,
Still afternoon by local standards. A proper Spaniard never ate dinner before sunset, and the lazy Andalusian sun seldom surrendered the skies before 10. Even in the early evening heat, Becker found himself walking across the park at a brisk clip. Strathmore's tone had sounded a lot more urgent this time than it had that morning. His new orders left no room for misinterpretation. Find the Canadian, get the ring. Do whatever is necessary, just get that ring. Becker wondered what could possibly be so important about a ring with lettering all over it. Strathmore hadn't offered, and Becker hadn't asked. NSA, he thought. Never say anything. On the other side of Avenida Isabella Católica, the clinic was clearly visible. The universal symbol of a red cross in a white circle painted on the roof. The Guardia officer had dropped the Canadian off hours ago. Broken wrist, bumped head. No doubt the patient had been treated and discharged by now. Becker just hoped the clinic had discharge information. A local hotel or phone number where the man could be reached. With a little luck, Becker figured he could find the Canadian, get the ring, and be on his way home without any more complications. Strathmore had told Becker,
"Use the 10,000 cash to buy the ring if you have to. I'll reimburse you."
"That's not necessary," Becker had replied. He'd intended to return the money anyway. He hadn't gone to Spain for money. He'd gone for Susan. Commander Trevor Strathmore was Susan's mentor and guardian. Susan owed him a lot. A one-day errand was the least Becker could do. Unfortunately, things this morning hadn't gone quite as Becker had planned. He'd hoped to call Susan from the plane and explain everything. He considered having the pilot radio Strathmore so he could pass along a message, but was hesitant to involve the deputy director in his romantic problems. 3 times Becker had tried to call Susan himself, first from a defunct cellular on board the jet, next from a payphone at the airport, then again from the morgue. Susan was not in. David wondered where she could be. He'd gotten her answering machine, but had not left a message. What he wanted to say was not a message for an answering machine. As he approached the road, he spotted a phone booth near the park entrance. He jogged over, snatched up the receiver, and used his phone card to place the call. There was a long pause as the number connected. Finally, it began to ring.
"Come on, be there."
After 5 rings, the call connected. "Hi, this is Susan Fletcher. Sorry, I'm not in right now, but if you leave your name..." Becker listened to the message.
Where is she?
By now, Susan would be panicked. He wondered if maybe she'd gone to Stone Manor without him. There was a beep. "Hi, it's David." He paused, unsure what to say. One of the things he hated about answering machines was that if you stopped to think, they cut you off. "Sorry I didn't call," he blurted just in time. He wondered if he should tell her what was going on. He thought better of it. "Call Commander Strathmore. He'll explain everything." Becker's heart was pounding. This is absurd, he thought. "I love you," he added quickly, and hung up. Becker waited for some traffic to pass on Avenida Borbola. He thought about how Susan undoubtedly would have assumed the worst. It was unlike him not to call when he promised to. Becker stepped out onto the 4-lane boulevard. "In and out," he whispered to himself. "In and out." He was too preoccupied to see the man in wire-rimmed glasses watching from across the street. Chapter 18. Standing before the huge plate-glass window in his Tokyo skyrise, Numataka took a long pull on his cigar and smiled to himself. He could scarcely believe his good fortune. He had spoken to the American again, and if all was going according to the timetable, Ensai Tankado had been eliminated by now, and his copy of the passkey had been confiscated. It was ironic, Numataka thought, that he himself would end up with Ensai Tankado's passkey. Tokugen Numataka had met Tankado once many years ago. The young programmer had come to Numatech Corp fresh out of college searching for a job. Numataka had denied him. There was no question that Tankado was brilliant, but at the time there were other considerations. Although Japan was changing, Numataka had been trained in the old school. He lived by the code of menboko, honor and face. Imperfection was not to be tolerated. If he hired a cripple, he would bring shame on his company. He had disposed of Tankado's resume without a glance. Numataka checked his watch again. The American, North Dakota, should have called by now. Numataka felt a tinge of nervousness. He hoped nothing was wrong. If the passkeys were as good as promised, they would unlock the most sought-after product of the computer age, a totally invulnerable digital encryption algorithm. Numataka could embed the algorithm in tamper-proof, spray-sealed VSLI chips and mass-market them to world computer manufacturers, governments, industries, and perhaps even the darker markets, the black market of world terrorists. Numataka smiled. It appeared, as usual, that he had found favor with the Shichigo-san, the seven deities of good luck. Numatech Corp. was about to control the only copy of Digital Fortress that would ever exist. $20 million was a lot of money, but considering the product, it was the steal of the century.
This book is continued on Disc 3.